Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So, welcome to another episode in our endurance month this February, and I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker, and my name is, of course, Mike Finch, and we've had one episode of our endurance podcasts earlier this month where we talked in general about what endurance was and the kind of training that people needed to do with it, but we felt that we needed to get stuck into the weeds of the fuel and nutrition space, which is a very complicated, often there's a lot of talk about it. There's lots of theories. There's lots of snake oils out there that people talk about in terms of nutrition and fuel for endurance events. So I thought we'd tackle Ross on this and kind of get stuck into some of the bigger issues here. And we'll get stuck into some of them, Ross. But it is one of those things where there is so many products on the market. There's so many theories. There's fad diets. There's keto. There's carb depletion. There's excess carb. There's, I remember back in the 80s, comrades runners here in South Africa used to do this diet where they would not do any carbs for 5 days before, and then the last 2 days they would then hit the carbs pretty hard, and that was what everybody did. Now nobody does that at all, etc., etc. So it is one of those things where, you know, depending where you are, there's a lot of theories and almost like what is the current fad in terms of what people do in terms of nutrition and fuel for endurance events.
Yes, and I think it speaks to the importance of nutrition for endurance, because in our first episode we spoke about five or six challenges that every athlete doing an endurance activity has to overcome. And you go into those activities knowing that if you successfully overcome them, you'll finish or win or achieve whatever it is you're trying to get out of it. And if you don't, you won't. You fail. And nutrition is the one unavoidable. Because whether it's a marathon or an ultramarathon or a multi-stage day cycle race you're doing, or a winter sport, cross-country skiing expedition, whatever it is, nutrition is the one thing that will trip you up if you don't get it right. Because the body, as we are about to learn, can only fuel a certain intensity for a certain period of time before the tanks run dry. And at the point the tanks run dry, the exercise stops by design. And yeah. So we have to solve it. And so that creates the space that then people try and insert these products into, because you can sell to a need. And then it also creates really fascinating scientific theories and understandings, and you alluded to one, which was the carb loading one, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about, and how that practice has evolved, and the pendulum swings from one side to the next, and I'm sure it gets confusing for people. So hopefully this episode can resolve some of that confusion and give people three things to help them solve the challenge.
Yeah, and I think that's really what I want to do. I mean, that's kind of what I want to get out of it to some extent, because, you know, working in this space a lot of the time, if you speak to individual endurance athletes, it seems that every single endurance athlete has their own version of how they would fuel and do their nutrition on endurance events. I watched the Ultra Trail Cape Town here in Cape Town, which is a 100-kilometer trail run, which some of the best runners of the world did, including Jim Walmsley. And some of those people were fueling with one of the runners was running with stopping at the water points and having sweet potato, for instance. That was his thing that he went with. And I thought to myself, that's a good idea. You know, maybe I should do that on my next ride or whatever. Not very practical on a ride. But it's those sort of things that I find quite fascinating, is that it seems to be one of those things where if it works for you, stick with it. But it's hard to find the thing that works for you, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah, it's kind of like in business, you get mass customization where you get everyone has to do sort of the same thing, but there's variations within the theme.
Yeah.
And that's actually very important for people to remember here, is that what we say are not rules, they're principles or guidelines. And so whether that person is eating sweet potatoes or pretzels or drinking an expensive sports drink, they can achieve the same principle or fulfill or meet whatever it is, the same principle in three different ways.
Yeah.
So there is individual variation within an overall theme. But then, of course, there are also exceptions to the overall. So then you will find people who absolutely swear that they are completely unaffected by not having any carbs at all.
Yeah.
And they will have milk for a marathon or an ultra marathon.
Yeah, I heard that.
Which has carbs, by the way. So it's not maybe the best example. But so we will say things in the next 45 minutes, and maybe you'll be listening to this and saying, but that doesn't apply to me. And that could very well be the case. Mm. So there is a lot of research on this. It's probably one of the most researched areas of sports science and physiology. And that research has given us a good idea of what works the best for the most, but not necessarily for all. And then you have to become your own scientist and play and experiment in your training sessions to understand your needs and preferences, bold and underlined, because that makes all the difference. Mm. You can know the theory, but if it doesn't suit you, then it's useless. And then figure out for yourself what works best within what we're about to say.
And when you say principles, I mean, do the principles generally apply, although the variations are different? I mean, is it, if people want to take something out of this podcast, do you want them to remember the principles because they are scientific and fairly good in terms of what you can believe?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. And there'll be dispute because we live at a time now when everything's polarized. And so there'll be low carbers and high carbers, yeah, and so on. And say, no, that what you're saying is actually outdated. And show me the money that Big Pharma's given you to say this stuff. I've never seen any myself.
Yes.
So it's quite a polarized issue, which is maybe why we're in our fourth season before we've tackled it. But there are principles. And so there are, four or five things that you need to be able to say, yes, I'm doing that and I'm avoiding those because there are some things that can trip you up. Mm. But if you're able to say those, then you will be nutritionally, you'll be succeeding. You'll be fueling yourself appropriately. And so maybe before we get onto the details, the key is there's no such thing as good or bad or right or wrong. There's appropriate and inappropriate, maybe, is the best way to think of it. You know, suitable for that occasion is the way to think about this. And maybe suitable for that occasion for you, specifically as the listener.
Mm. Well, we haven't been sponsored or taken over or given money by anything from a big pharmaceutical company or anybody. And Bill Gates hasn't injected us with a weird
big sugar,
sugar or something like that. So we're pretty independent in what we're going to talk about. So let's break it down right from the simplest basic form. We talk about fuels. What are the categories of fuels that we need to know?
So unlike cars, we have three. You know, your car runs on one. Maybe it's got two tanks. We've got many tanks of three types of fuels. We have carbohydrates, so that's sugar. Glycogen is the storage form. So we store in our muscles and in our liver. Those are the two primary tanks that store sugar as glycogen. When we exercise, glycogen is broken down into glucose, and that's what provides energy. Number two, fat. Again, there are two main storage tanks, as it were, fat. One is in the muscle, and what are called inside, muscular triglycerides. That's fat cells. And then you also have adipose tissue, which need no explanation because everyone always wants to get rid of them. So adipose tissue is by far the most abundant source of energy we have. And so, in fact, when humans go on hunger strikes and don't eat anything at all, adipose tissue is so abundant it keeps us alive for weeks. That's how much we have of it.
Yeah.
Never in danger of running out, unlike carbohydrates. And then the final one is protein, stored everywhere, but I suppose for this conversation, primarily in muscle. And what happens then is if you have a major energy deficit, which is to say your energy demand is much, much higher than your energy supply, proteins can become a source of fuel because we can break them down and then turn their building blocks, which are called amino acids, into energy. So we can oxidize the amino acids that make a protein. And when you see, again, hunger strikes, or just to bring it back to athletics and exercise achievements, polar explorers. I spoke last time about the Robert Scott and his compatriots. They lost 40% of their body mass. There is a significant degree of protein breakdown in order to achieve that weight loss. So that's what happens when you get nutrition wrong for long enough. That's not at play in even most ultra marathons.
So you don't want to be going into a space where you're using protein as fuel, really?
No, you don't. And people have always known that. And that's why Scott and his team, when they try to get to the South Pole, they packed rations full of protein. And it turned out to be a mistake. Because what you really want to do is keep the energy supply high, because that's what causes the protein to be broken down. Make sense?
Yeah.
Your body doesn't really go into the net oxidation. I say net because when we exercise, we do break down protein. There is oxidation of amino acids during exercise. So when you and I go on our bike rides, a marathon run, or whatever it is, there is amino acid oxidation, but it's not net oxidation because protein synthesis happens at the same rate as breakdown. Make sense?
Right, yeah.
So it's almost like we put those amino acids back into the circulating pool, but then when exercise stops, they just get taken back up and used again. It's only when we push ourselves so far into energy deficit that amino acid pool starts to actually be spent. It's kind of like your reserves in your bank account. And as long as you've got some income and every month, you never touch them. But if you're unemployed for 6 months, now you start spending them, and that's not good.
Yeah.
So that's the short answer. Now, we do have other forms of energy, sources of energy, for example, ketones, which we'll talk about, no doubt. Lactate is a source of energy. But ketones come from fat oxidation. Mm. Lactate comes from carbohydrate oxidation. So the simple answer is that there are three: carbs, fat, and protein. But really, if you get it right, it's carbs and fat.
Well, let's, now that you've mentioned it, let's talk about those ketones and what was the other one you're talking about?
Lactate.
Lactate. I mean, I've obviously working on the magazines and Runner's World and Bicycling, we talk a lot about how lactate can become a fuel.
Mm.
So when you're burning your legs up a hill, actually you can use that fuel effectively if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Ketones is controversial because very much involved in the cycling space at the moment around the world, a lot of professional athletes. Mm. And in fact, you can buy ketone supplements now, which you can take that supposedly up your ketone level. Give us a bit of a description about, first of all, let's start with ketones. Is it, as they suspect in the cycling fraternity at the moment, where people are taking ketones so they can reduce their fats so that they are very super lean athletes when they're climbing, therefore more efficient as athletes?
So the evidence on the ketones in those athletes is actually quite slim still. In fact, there was a study, it was either last year or the year before, I've lost track, that showed no benefit, which is interesting.
Really?
But I'm of the opinion that if those elite athletes have used it for a number of years and are continuing to use it, it's because they believe there is a benefit. Now, is that placebo or no? I don't know. But I suspect that there probably might be at that level, for those athletes, there might be a tiny benefit. And the way it would provide benefit, let's talk theory first. So ketone bodies are produced when fat oxidation rates are very high. So we break down fats, triglycerides, fatty acids. And when that happens at very high rates, the end consequence is a number of these molecules called ketone bodies. Acetone is one of them. There's another one, beta-hydroxybutyrate, I think is the name. So that's when a dietitian or a doctor assesses you and you're ketotic, it's because you are oxidizing fats at an unnaturally high rate, which happens, for example, in diabetics because they can't break down sugars and so they overconsume fat. Make sense?
Yeah.
Now, for the purposes of sport, the theory is that if you can use ketones at the muscle, then you're getting energy from that source and it would then have a carbohydrate sparing effect. And also, ketones would be able to provide energy. I think the brain is able to use ketone bodies as well, which makes sense because if you're in a state of survival because of starvation, the brain normally wants glucose as its first priority or preference. If you don't have that, because as we've said already, I think I mentioned, the glucose stores run out fairly quickly. The fat stores never do. So the brain has evolved to be able to use those ketone bodies as well. So the idea behind supplementation with ketones is very similar to the idea behind supplementation with many other products and substances. It's what can I do to decrease the reliance on carbohydrates and not compromise energy delivery at the cell? That's what all of them are doing. 20 years ago, it was medium chain triglycerides. You could get these short fat molecules that you would be able to take in, and they would provide that source of energy.
Mm.
That never really took hold because they caused people to be quite sick, gastrointestinal issues and so on. It's the same with many other dietary interventions. Can I increase how much I rely on fats and then as a trade-off need less from carbs, which is going to be beneficial? So that's where all that comes from. So an athlete who has a very low carb diet is going to be producing ketones and using them for fuel. And the idea was we can supplement with this and achieve benefits without being low carb.
And the benefit is that you can use them as fuel more effectively if you're supplementing with that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And all as right. yet, I in my opinion, sound theory, but not yet enough evidence to say, yes, it definitely works. But the fact that they've been used for 5 or 6 years now in professional cycling, I suspect there's they'll know that there's a benefit there that hasn't yet been shown in a lab study.
So I know Jumbo Visma were famously using ketones at one point. So I'm not sure whether they have continued with that program, but at one stage there was lots of talk about them using ketones. So.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that most of those top teams have either tried or are using them right now.
Okay, so just to very briefly, because we have to move on to today, but lactate, I mean, that again, as I said, it's one of those things where, again, it's also a fuel, isn't it?
Lactate's a fuel. So lactate was first identified probably almost 100 years ago, and it was a molecule that was labeled the bad guy of metabolism, in part because back then they didn't have all the tools we have now, and so all they were able to measure was in amphibian frog muscles. If you stimulated that frog muscle, everything was cool, but if you stimulated too much, it failed, and at the moment that it failed, you could measure this thing that they eventually called lactate. And so they put two and two together and got five and said lactate's causing the failure. And that stuck. I mean, you know, you as a magazine editor, you would have seen many times lactate poisoning the muscle. That was its reputation. But in about probably the late 80s, 90s, very famous physiologist called George Brooks started to do these much more insightful studies using much better equipment and technology. And he was able to find that lactate shuttles from one compartment to the next. So it's produced in the muscle. It then goes into the blood, it's taken to other organs, and it's actually used as a source of energy in those organs. And so rather than being the bad guy that inhibits exercise, lactate's probably the thing that keeps it going, because without the ability to form lactate, the whole process of carboxidation would grind to a halt. Because what happens is we break glucose down in a series of steps that eventually gives us ATP. Somewhere along that pathway,
let me see if I can get this right. Adenosine triphosphate.
Almost. Adenosine.
Adenosine, that's it.
Adenosine triphosphate. And so adenosine, ATP is what we need to power muscle contraction. That's the guy that gives us the energy. It's made off of the glucose, the fatty acids, and the amino acids potentially, right? So glucose is broken down in a, you can almost imagine a conveyor belt in a factory, and it's a molecule is handed from one station to the next.
Yeah.
And at each handover, it's changed very slightly. And one of those changes forms a molecule called pyruvate. And then the pyruvate can either go into this process that it continues down the oxidation pathway to produce ATP, which is good. But if the rate at which pyruvate is coming is too high and the demand is really high, then that person handling that pyruvate in our analogous factory situation can't deal with it. So he basically palms it off as lactate somewhere else. Right. So lactate's almost the way that we deal with a bottleneck.
Right.
And so all of a sudden this pyruvate gets converted to lactate by an enzyme called lactate dehydrogenase. And that's really important because it allows metabolism to keep going. Otherwise it would literally just jam to a halt at that point, right?
Right.
What then happens is that lactate is very mobile. It's a small molecule. It very easily escapes the muscle cell. It goes to the kidneys, the liver, wherever it is. And it goes the other way. So now it goes back from lactate to pyruvate, and then it can be used as a source of energy in those tissues. So it's a very clever system where lactate actually becomes the enabler of the metabolic pathways.
So, I mean, in simple terms, if I'm running along and my legs are starting to really burn, and I'm saying to myself, this is an indication that I should slow down because my legs are burning, in simple terms, that's not true. That's just lactate coming through as a consequence of exercise.
Yeah, we'd measure lactate levels are probably quite high because the point at which your legs start burning is quite high intensity exercise. Yeah. And lactate is there when exercise intensity is high. It doesn't mean it's causing the burn. So what's happened there is we've measured A and B, and we've inferred that they both are caused by C, or that A causes B, rather, let me get that right. We've measured high lactate. We've seen that you're slowing down and your legs are burning, and we've assumed that the lactate's the cause.
Right.
And it's not. There could be an independent process that's causing both those things, and that's probably the case. And so the intensity drives the rate at which you need glucose to be oxidized. As I exercise faster and faster, my power output's going up, my running speed, or I'm going up a steep climb and I'm trying to hold the pace, I now need to produce ATP so much more quickly than I did a minute or two earlier. And that's what's causing a number of metabolic changes. So phosphate accumulation as we carve that ATP into energy, ADP and PI, calcium potentially accumulation in the muscles, hydrogen ion accumulation as a result of these shuttles that are trying to keep the balance the same from one side, on one side of the membrane and the other, if that makes sense. We can leave it at that high level stuff. And so yes, lactate is there almost as a flag that something's happening in the metabolic system, but it's not necessarily the thing causing what we feel.
Yeah. It's not the brain saying to the muscle, you need to slow down. It's just a consequence of exercise.
Well, that's, we feel it as pain because it's being interpreted at the level of the brain. And there's this afferent feedback from metabolic and mechanical receptors in the muscle. And yes, we'll feel that as pain, but that signal's not lactate. Mm. It's all the other things, hydrogen, calcium, phosphate.
So it's possible to push through lactate, in other words. I suppose that's the nub of it all, isn't it? It's possible to, when you feel that, you can keep pushing. It's not your body saying, slow down. It's a consequence. It's
up to a point, because again, the lactate is a marker of the fact that you are now exercising beyond what for you would be steady state.
Right.
And by definition, the moment we go higher than our steady state exercise, we're now in borrowed time.
Right.
But it's no longer steady state. Yeah. This is a 10 minutes before I'm done task.
So it is actually a marker of exercise that you can't just keep going.
No, but it's not that you're pushing through lactate.
Right.
It's just that you're pushing through all the things that also are associated with having high lactate.
Is that that makes sense. So let's talk about when we need these fuels, because we're talking specifically about endurance athletes and endurance sport at this stage. And from my very limited knowledge on this, obviously we know that sugars are the fast burning guys. In other words, when you have intensity, you want to be able to burn something as quickly available. Therefore, glycogen and sugars are there.
Exactly.
Whereas the fat is the slow burning stuff.
Yeah.
Is it as simple as that?
Pretty much. The key is rate. I mean, that's what it's about. How quickly can I get the energy to the muscle? That's the point.
Yeah.
And carbohydrates are used very quickly in comparison with fats. Because when we need to get fat to ATP, it involves, I think there were 9 steps.
Mm.
You know, that fatty acid is sitting inside your adipose tissue or your muscle. It's first got to be activated, then mobilized, then transported from the adipose tissue to the muscle. When it gets there, it has to be offloaded. So it's got to go from one taxi to the next. It's then got to get inside the muscle cell. Then it's got to get inside the mitochondria. Then it's got to be broken down. Then it's got to be oxidized. So in actual fact, from start to finish, adipose tissue is time-consuming and less efficient, even though every gram of fat provides you with 9 calories compared to only 4 per gram of carbs.
Mm.
And that's why the prospect of being a better fat burner is so enticing, because if I could make that process from start to finish more efficient and more effective, I would be able to get so much more energy out so much more quickly.
Yeah.
And
that's what everybody talks about, isn't it?
And
I'm a fat burner.
And the fact that I'm never going to run out of it.
Mm.
I mean, I've got 2 hours of carbs in me, depending how hard I go, maybe less, maybe a little bit more. But I've got 2 weeks, 2 months sometimes of fat. So the prospect of being a better fat burner is very attractive. But to answer your original question, it's carbs for when the demand is high, because the rate is set by muscle contraction. You know, you're consuming ATP in order to power muscle contraction. And again, if you think about that factory, there's a foreman at the end of the chain saying, guys, send more. We need more here. If we don't get more here, you're going to fail. Your muscles are going to lock up. You're going to tie up. This is going to be a disaster. So get energy now.
Yeah.
And then they say, well, where's that energy best coming from? Carbs, because it's quicker. And so
until it runs out.
Yes. Yeah. And so we start breaking down glycogen in the muscle. Glycogen gets converted to glucose. There's an enzyme that does that. We break it down in the liver, and then it gets released into the bloodstream. And that's important because the brain needs it and the muscles need it. And so
the process of sugar being converted into energy as opposed to fat being converted into energy is a longer process. Therefore, that's why there is that difference in the way those fuels are used.
Fat being longer. Correct, yes.
Okay. Yeah. It's just more taxis it has to get into.
Yeah, taxis have got to get into and doors it's got to pass through. You know, to get from where it starts to where it's going is, I'm going to be misquoting now, but it's 4 taxis and 4 doors, whereas glucose, it's really right there, unless it's in the liver, and then it's one door and it's in the circulation. You know, fat needs albumin, for instance. And so one of the things that's been found is that when we exercise really hard, like high intensity, short duration, the circulation changes, as we've discussed. We send the blood where it's needed, which is muscle and skin. And we therefore, because it's not an infinite supply, we divert it away from where it's not needed. And one of those places is the adipose tissue. So there are studies that have found that when we do very high intensity exercise, the fat cells actually get trapped because they can't get out. It's as though there's a massive traffic jam and all the cars have been sent somewhere else, and now you've got these stranded adipose cells, and they can't. So yes, that's the point.
Is that the body's going into like an emergency space, isn't it? Where it's going like, okay, I need fuel fast. We're going to shut down everything else and just make sure we get this energy from the fastest available.
And it's all being mediated by adrenaline and noradrenaline, which is the sympathetic fight or flight hormones. Mm. And so that changes the circulation. It changes the hormones. We no longer have insulin in the circulation. We switch it off. The adrenaline drives the oxidation of carbs. And so it's actually quite a beautiful system where the rate sets the demand, which is then met by the supply. And the body is clever enough to say, if the supply is this, it's coming mostly carbs. If the supply is that, and that being lower, we can do this on fats. And so what you then get is what's called the crossover concept, where at low exercise intensities, most of our energy comes from fat, with a small proportion from carbs. Yeah. So let's call it 90-10. 90% from fat, 10% from carbs. That's at walking pace. As we speed up...
So it's not possible to be 100% fat.
No, it is. At complete rest, your carb contributions will be very, very low. Okay. Maybe not 100. Because when you wake up in the morning, your liver glycogen is depleted, even if you've eaten the night before. And that's because your brain needs glucose. And that glucose is coming from the liver.
Okay, so your brain needs glucose, not necessarily doesn't use fat.
No, unless it's ketone bodies when you are completely glucose deplete, and then and your liver glycogen is finished. And then
always using glucose to some extent, but it's a scale of how much we use it. It's not a line.
No,
that's what I'm saying.
No, it's not. It's a spectrum. It's a dimmer switch, not an on-off switch.
Right. Okay.
And so what happens is, so let's say walking very gently through the shopping mall. 10 and 90, 10.
Which I hate, by the way.
Fats, carbs. Fats, carbs. If you eat carbs, your proportion from carbs goes up because the body burns what it has available.
Right.
If you're in a fasted state because you ate the night before and you haven't had breakfast and it's now lunchtime the day after, maybe it's 96.4% because your body doesn't have the carbs. It therefore burns the fat. It's clever
this
way.
Is it not burning based on intensity rather than what's available?
No, both.
Both.
It's,
okay.
So it's
I thought it was only intensity.
No, so it's set that the main driver of which fuel tank you access is the rate demand at the muscle level, which is the intensity.
Yeah.
But within that, there is play depending on how much you have available and how adapted you are to use the different fuel stores.
All right.
So a high fat meal would drive fat oxidation, and a high carb meal for a short time afterwards drives the use of carbohydrates. The body's clever. It uses what it has.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So as we then walk faster and break into a slow jog, the proportion from fat starts coming down. Now we're at 70, with 30% coming from carbs. Yeah. As we get a little bit quicker, now it's a moderate jog, which we call 50%. It's 60-40 fats, carbs. And then at some point, usually between 60 and 65%, they cross over and it's 50-50. So now half my energy is carb and half of it's coming from fat. And so what's happening is, as we go harder, more and more is coming from carbohydrates because it needs to, as we've discussed, right? You got all that.
Yeah.
And less is coming from fat. And this is all mediated by the sympathetic nervous system. Adrenaline is driving carb oxidation because it's activating the enzymes. It's switching off the enzymes from the fat side of the equation. Then we get to 80, 85%. Now it's looking like a mirror image. Now it's 80% carbs, 20% fat, until eventually there's hardly any fat use and it's only carbohydrates.
Okay.
So you can almost visualize if you had a y-axis here, this is a graph of percentage energy from the different stores as a function of intensity, it looks like an X.
Yeah.
Because the one's going up over time, the other one's coming down, and they cross over in the middle, and that's called the crossover concept.
So the important thing to remember there, and this is why it's quite a good lesson for me, is that there isn't this line, this turn, where it's suddenly it's all a gradual process in terms of carb or fat use. Whereas I think a lot of the a lot of the experts or a lot of the hype that we see around certain diets and fuels is that there's this almost like this point where if you go to that point, you're going to be burning glycogen and sugars and you can't go beyond that. But it's not like that.
And you have a fat burning zone and you suddenly switch. And I remember reading...
What you'd say, instead of having a fat burning zone, you have a majority fat burning zone.
Yeah, that would be exactly.
Better description.
Exactly. And if you wanted to be really literal about what I just explained, the first 65% is the fat burning zone because it's right up to that point, it's 50-50. So it's 51-49. It's fat, but it's not really. The way it's worded, it sounds like there's a switch that gets flicked and suddenly now I go into fat stores. And that doesn't happen.
Right.
It's a spectrum the whole time. And it's a spectrum of carbs and of fat. So when I talk about that X, they're not straight lines because like most things in physiology, they look exponential. So it's a curve, but it's a curved X. Mm. And it's not, you know, it's not a step. It's not a staircase. It's a slope. And so that's the fundamental point. And what's really interesting then is that your habitual diet shifts that curved X left or right. Your training, your fitness shifts that curve left or right. So, for instance, if you started now with like a 3-month big endurance block and you worked on your aerobic oxidative capacity, you know, that low intensity base type zone training, you would shift your curves to the right, which means that you would rely on fats for longer. So where today, for example, let's say that you, Mike Finch, could go out at 60% of your max and you'd be 50-50. In 3 months' time, you'd be 50-50 at 70% of your max. So in other words, your relative contribution of fats goes up as you get fitter and more adapted and trained. Make sense?
When you say more adapted, in other words, you have to do the training that encourages fat adaption, or just by getting fitter, do you become more fat adapted?
Those two things are the same.
Are they?
The training that makes you fitter is making you fitter by virtue of driving fat adaptation.
Okay.
Because the training that makes you fitter is increasing your mitochondrial capacity. You remember you did the ATP earlier. Remember what mitochondria are?
Yes. Adenase,
No, that was ATP. But do you remember what mitochondria are?
Yes. Those are the power cells of the,
that's right.
of the body. Yeah.
So all these enzymes. So earlier I used the analogy about a factory and a conveyor belt. The mitochondria is that factory.
Yeah.
And every little step along that conveyor belt is an enzyme that is housed inside the mitochondria. So in order for us to be fat burners, we need high mitochondrial mass because the enzymes that are going to enable us to turn fatty acids eventually into ATP are in that mitochondria.
Right.
So with training, we develop more mitochondria. We make more of them.
And is it true that much more mitochondria develop when you are training at a lower intensity?
Yeah, so they're always developing in response to the training stress. But low intensity training, aerobic training, oxidative stress is what causes that. So therefore, a fit endurance trained athlete has got more enzymes to be able to turn fat into fuel than someone who's unfit or himself 6 months before. So why was I talking about that? Because with training, that crossover then happens later. So a fit athlete. So when we watch the upcoming classics in cycling and we're seeing these guys on the bike for 5-6 hours at a time, they are exercising at a high intensity without needing to access their carb stores like you or I would, even at the same relative intensity. Obviously, if I'm in that peloton in Paris-Roubaix and I'm having to ride 350 watts, I've got 2 minutes in me and I'm done.
Yes.
They've got 2 hours. Yeah. But relatively, you know, they're at 85% of VO2 max. They're still using more fat than I would be at my 85 because they're just that good at it.
That's a very important fact, actually, that people understand that.
Yeah, so that's what training does. It turns us into fat-burning machines. Also, we also get better at burning carbs and protein, by the way. There's evidence that the enzymes that can burn or oxidize amino acids go up with training. So everything gets better. But you see that effect most with fat because that's the one that's limited in the first place by how much mitochondria and aerobic oxidative capacity you have.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So now that we've talked about the different fuel sources, I think one of the questions, and people talk about it in marathons and Ironman events, any long sort of endurance event, is hitting the wall, bonking, whatever you want to call it. There's lots of talk about that. It's if you work in a magazine like Runner's World or Bicycling, with anywhere in the world, that's probably the number one story that you get the hits on your website. So give us an idea of what it means to hit the wall. What does hitting the wall actually mean?
So in this context, it means running out of energy, fuel tank running dry. And we know by now that the only fuel tank that can run dry is the carbohydrate one. Well, there are two of them. It's either the liver glycogen is depleted or the muscle glycogen is depleted. And in the early days, when they first developed the techniques to measure what was happening in the liver and the muscle, because they could do biopsies and doubly labeled techniques to check where the glucose was and wasn't, there was some debate around whether the concept of hitting the wall or going hyperglycemic was the consequence of what's happening in the muscle.
So hyperglycemic is?
Low sugar.
Low sugar, okay. Just break that word down.
So hypo, low, glycemia, meaning sugar, you know, like the old glycemic index. Right. So, and it's actually interesting to look that one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is you can now get portable glucose monitors.
Yes.
So in the same way that you can measure your heart rate, you can now measure your glucose levels.
It's incredible, isn't it?
And it took a while for them to be.
Froome uses one, I think.
Does he?
Yeah.
So for a while it took they weren't valid. I mean, they were measuring something, but no one was absolutely sure that it was the right thing. But I think they've gotten now to the point that they're actually valid. Now the question is, are they useful? Because does it help you really to know?
Sounds very useful to me.
Well, I'm not convinced actually. But let's say you go out and you exercise and it's an easy 1 hour ride or run, whatever it is. What you'll find is that your blood glucose level sits at a base level of say 5. And it goes up to 5.5, 6 initially, because when we start exercise, our stress response kicks in. And so the adrenaline and the noradrenaline that I spoke of earlier suddenly send their little signals to say to the body, start producing energy. And we do that. And the consequence is that we send the glucose that was stored in the liver into the bloodstream. And that's what we see. We measure a pickup in it. And then it kind of stays there because we achieve a new level of balance. You know, it's like changing the setting on your air conditioner from 18 degrees to 24. It's higher than it was, but it's still this constant. And it's only if we go for hours without replenishing that then starts to be under strain. And then what happens is the glucose levels will start dropping because our liver glycogen is starting to be depleted and we can no longer put that glucose into the bloodstream. And when that happens, and this is, I'm sure, a sensation familiar to everyone, we start getting lightheaded, tunnel vision, maybe a little bit sweaty, weak. We feel like we're exercising comfortably, but we can't go any harder. Have you had this feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I can. Often people talk about whether you have having a proper hitting the wall versus having just a bit of a dip. And I remember a few years ago going out on a ride and having a proper sugar depletion where I literally could hardly turn the pedals over. I ended up sitting outside a supermarket down the road eating, I think, 2 Chelsea buns and a 0.5 liter Coke.
Yes.
And then I was able to get back on the bike within half an hour after that. But when I say I couldn't turn the pedals over, I literally was struggling to get 1 foot over the
feeling. It really is.
It's diabolical. And it's quite scary, actually, because I guess that's the question, because it feels like you are in real trouble, physically you're in danger here.
And if you weren't in a city where you could get a Chelsea bun or two and a 0.5 liter Coke, you might be. I've had it as well. I mean, I remember cycling around the point and I got to Cape Point Gate and luckily there was a tailwind behind and it's largely downhill because I couldn't pedal. I had to walk up the hills.
Yeah.
And all you want to do is lie down on the side of the road and have a nap. That's how I felt. And so that's a classic manifestation of like being super low in sugar. So now your blood glucose is really low. And because that's your brain's preferred, so that's why you have these central perception issues arise, like sleepiness and drowsiness, dizziness. You'll see it when you if you go on YouTube and look up famous examples, dramatic marathon finishes, you'll see what happens to people when they get hyperglycemic. Not to be confused with heat stroke, which we spoke about two episodes back. But
they can be confused, can't they?
Yeah, they do look the same. But I mean, once you're there on the side of the road, you'll know. Yeah. I mean, it's fairly obvious when there's a heat stroke compared to a sugar issue.
So why doesn't your body in that situation then not return to fats, for instance, to keep you fueled?
It's trying, but by that stage, it's too late. You've gone past the point of no return. Mm. Guarantee that there was probably for half an hour before that you were pushing through something you shouldn't have been. but remember, the rate is setting the demand.
Yeah.
And so you're asking the muscles to contract and produce the same power of 180, 200 watts as you were an hour or two earlier, but it can only do that by oxidizing glucose, and then eventually the glucose gets to such a low level that you just can't power normal brain function anymore.
And is the only solution then is to ingest carbohydrates?
Yeah, and you could have gotten off your bike and walked.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, could have. Yeah.
Because there's enough fat that the fat can do that job.
Right.
So in answer to your question from a minute or so ago, your body could, but it would just require you to basically stop exercise and just walk. Because then you'd go back to that 90-10 point on that spectrum, right, where 90% comes from fats and you've got that, and you only need 10% from carbs and you've got just enough to get you to the shop.
Yeah,
and then it resolves quickly, right?
Yes,
you get back on the bike 20 minutes later. The moment that glucose, because remember the adage is, if it's in the stomach and the intestine, it's still outside the body. So the moment it gets from the intestine into the blood, problem solved, gone.
Solved, yeah.
And you can actually get on the bike and you feel like nothing ever happened. So, anyway,
I read a story a while back saying that once you start ingesting carbohydrates, just with the fact that the carbohydrate is going into your mouth, your body then responds to that, even though it actually hasn't gone into your system.
You don't have to swallow it for there to
you
be
don't
a benefit.
Have to swallow it. Yeah,
that was a famous series of studies. Yeah, there were now, at last check I looked, there were 15 studies, and 10 of them had found a significant effect from only rinsing the mouth with a carb.
So the body's going, oh, here's some sugar.
So there must be sensors in the mouth that tell it that there's sugar connected to the brain, and then the brain thinks there's carbs available. So that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it means that can cut both ways. You could deceive yourself into thinking you've got energy, you don't, but you can also benefit because you don't really need to have a drink on hand to swallow.
No.
You can just rinse and have small sips frequently and create the perception that your tanks are full.
If your tank is empty at that point, though, and you have fooled the brain, I guess it won't take long before you start feeling bad again.
No, right, because eventually, like, there's nothing there, It's the emperor's clothes. I mean, at some stage,
and
it's revealed.
If they measure the glycogen that's in the liver and the blood at that point, where this hitting the wall scenario happens, is it zero? I mean, is it like...
No, it differs for different people, so there are different sensitivities. And I remember from those studies, because as I said earlier, there was a debate or dispute around whether it's the muscle glycogen that runs out or the liver. But it depends on the circumstances and the situation. Sometimes it's the liver, and then you get the central hyperglycemia because the brain is denied its sugars. Other times it's the muscle hyperglycemia. But the liver, so in other words, you can keep the blood glucose levels normal and deplete the muscle. You still fail. But you don't fail at zero. You fail at a very low concentration, which is a range, because some people fail with half of what other people take to fail. And some people can only deal with, let's say, concentration of 20, whereas for most people it's 8. So sensitivities make a big difference to that, yeah.
So for people going out and doing a long, either an Ironman, marathon, ultra marathon, that sort of thing, when you get to that point where you know you've run out of sugar, is it safe to say that once you replenish that sugar and you do so, you will probably recover and can continue? It's not the end of the race necessarily.
No, you can recover. Yeah. You might not recover to how you would have been had you avoided that situation in the first place, because there's some evidence that your carb intake, for instance, prevents muscle damage, which is really very interesting. There have been studies in these ultramarathon runners in Spain where they did this 4-hour simulated trail race, and they taught these ultramarathon runners how to consume 120 grams of carbs an hour, which is a ridiculous amount. I mean, guarantee most of you listening to this are in the 40 to 50 grams an hour. So now you've got to increase that threefold. And what they found was that if you did that, you got less muscle damage and you got less neuromuscular fatigue after that 4-hour run. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you under-consume and if you under-fuel, particularly with carbs, you probably are causing muscular consequences that you don't recover from very quickly. You do, but it's not like you can just drink that half liter of Coke and you'll be back to normal. You're back to good enough to ride back home, but you're not. Yeah, let's just say you wouldn't want to do it in a race.
So that leads me on to our next, and this is an area where I find it enormously confusing, is to understand. You talk very briefly about X amount of carbohydrates per hour, and we run stories in Runner's World and Bicycle here in South Africa where we talk about you must, have 10 grams per 1 kilogram of mass per hour, that sort of thing. It's a very broad question to ask you, but how does one understand what you need to do in terms of your fueling strategy? If you're saying that you need to ingest a certain amount, if you look at a bottle of an energy drink and it says this drink has X amount of carbohydrates in it, and therefore if you mix it like this, if I take five sips out of this every 15 minutes, I should get my carbohydrate intake for that hour. I mean, is there an easy way to explain that?
I hope so. I'll try. So again, the carbohydrate requirements during exercise are determined largely by the intensity, which is a function of duration. So 30 minutes of exercise is assumed, if it's a race situation, obviously, it's assumed to be much more intense than an hour, which of course is much more intense than running a marathon over 2-3 hours, which is much more intense than running a ultra trail, which is going to take 15 hours potentially.
Yeah.
So the main factor is probably the easiest way to think about it is how long am I going for? Because that drives what I need to fuel with. Anything less than 45 minutes doesn't need fueling.
Right.
If it's a hot day and you want to take something with just to keep the lips wet and from being thirsty, and that happens to have some carbs in, no problem. It's not going to do any harm, but it's not really necessary. Mm. When we get up to 45 minutes an hour to 2 hours, then you probably need 30 to 60 grams per hour of carbs. You could probably still get away with it because, again, our carb tanks are full enough that we can power an hour and a half to 2 hours of exercise. Mm. But you're probably still slightly better off. There is now, the research suggests, there's a dose response where the more carbs I consume, the better I perform. Mm-hmm. That's the case. I mean, there's one study where they looked at a range from 30 all the way to, from zero all the way to 60 grams per hour. And the people who take 60 grams per hour do better than those who take 30, who do better than those who take none.
Right.
So you probably want to try and get at least 30 grams an hour in.
And how do you know that? I mean, how do you work that out?
I'll come to that in a moment. For longer durations, so now we're talking marathon and upwards, you probably want to try and get as much as tolerable. And I say that because that's where the thing becomes limiting. Because the from a practical perspective, carbohydrate oxidation rates, how much we burn, is limited by how much we can get into the blood from the gut.
Right.
And that is limited by biochemistry and physiology, which I'll get to shortly. So there are now, and I mentioned this, the Spanish marathon runners, they learned through training to consume 120 grams an hour. Which is crazy high. You know, the American College of Sports Medicine is like the body that drives knowledge in this field. Their recommendation used to be 30 to 60. And that was based on a number of studies and labs that had given athletes 100, 150, even 180 grams of carbs an hour to the point that almost all of them throw up and get sick. But they measure how much they oxidize, and it was capped at 60. Yeah. So there was this theory for a long time that said humans can at most only burn 1 gram per minute, 60 grams per hour.
That's all they measured.
Well, that was literally the limit. And it didn't matter if you gave the person 60 or 100 or 150, the oxidation rate was 60. So that was really interesting. So they said, okay, the rate limiting step, the weakest link in this chain must be something in the gut because you just didn't matter how much we gave you. That's what came out, right? So something in the middle was stopping it.
Yeah.
That something turned out to be something called the sodium glucose transporter, because from inside your intestine to get into your blood, the glucose has to be helped across. Basically, there's a doorman and it's got to open the door and let the glucose in, right? And that doorman is the sodium glucose transporter.
Yeah.
That transporter could not deal with more than 60 grams per hour. So it was the limiting step.
Right.
What they then discovered, and this was relatively recent in the last sort of 15 years or so, is that if you combined glucose with fructose, the glucose could use the door and the fructose could come through the window.
Okay.
So all of a sudden, you could burn more than 60. So they did a study, I think it was in the Netherlands.
What's the difference between glucose and fructose,
So glucose is the basic building block of sugar, but most people know that. It's grape sugar, effectively. Yeah. Fructose is fruit sugar. So they're slightly different metabolic chemical structures.
Right.
But
they're both sugars.
But they're both simple sugars.
Right.
But the key difference in this context is that fructose doesn't need that GLT, SGLT, sodium glucose transporter. It uses another one called GLUT5. So now you could get both in at the same time, and then you could add the effects together. Make sense?
Oh, okay.
So All of a sudden, these studies started coming out. Asker Jukendrup is probably the most famous scientist who's done this work, and they were finding that they could give these athletes in labs, cyclists, they could give them 100 grams an hour, and they'd burn it all, having previously thought there was a limit at 60. Right. And so nowadays, Ironman triathletes, top marathon runners, the ultra marathon runners, they are literally trying everything they can to teach their bodies how to get more and more and more in because it helps. And as I said to you, the studies have shown that if you consume more carbs during exercise, the exercise is less damaging.
Mm.
It causes less fatigue, perception of effort is lower, neuromuscular fatigue afterwards is reduced, and muscle damage is reduced.
So most of those gels and things that you get, I mean, they have a combination of glucose and fructose for that reason.
Yeah, and also like these other maltodextrins, for instance, which is a short glucose glucose. Yeah. You've seen that word before, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you now get all these other more sophisticated versions, but they really boil down to the same thing, is can I get the simple sugars into the intestine and then from the intestine into the blood?
Yeah.
And that's best done at high volumes if you consume at least 60 grams of glucose plus some fructose, because then they can both come in. You know, the glucose is using the door and the fructose is climbing through the window, and you're getting them both in. So, okay, so that's a lot of numbers and technical stuff. Let's get practical. A can of Coke is, I think, per 100 grams, about 10 grams of sugar.
Right.
So when I'm sitting here saying you need 60 grams an hour, you would need 600 mils of Coke.
That's a lot an hour, isn't it?
Yeah, that's you wouldn't want to drink a fizzy Coke. Yeah, six of those an hour, right?
Yeah.
600 mils, not six cans, 600 mils. Powerade, most people will be aware of. In the States, they've got Gatorade. We've got Energade. It's got different names in other places. Mm. I know in the Middle East, it's called Pocari Sweat, which is quite funny. drink some sweat. The concentration sugars in those tend to be between 7.5% and 8.5%, 9%, which means what? That every 100 mils of that drink contains about 8 grams of sugar. So 60 grams is 800 mils, 750 mils. Right. Again, quite a lot, right?
Yeah.
So you can see actually that this bar of 60 grams an hour is quite hard to get to.
Yeah.
And that's why earlier I said, when you're doing ultra endurance exercise, you drink as much as tolerable. Because actually, that's probably more limiting than the...
Because you're not going to get to the 60 most likely.
Probably not. Yeah. But if you really are serious about this, you should try. And you can teach yourself to do this, right? By the way. There's gut training exercises. That Spanish study I mentioned earlier with the marathon runners, they put them through 3 weeks of like gradually more and more and more and more, so that 3 weeks later they could take 120. And the guy who did the study reported that some of them had gastro problems, but mostly they got away with it.
Sure.
So it's got to be the right type.
Right.
Coke is often too sweet because the concentration is so high. And the problem with high concentrations is now you get sugar sitting in the stomach and the gut, and then water goes in instead of the other way around. And then you get all sorts of nausea and bloating and gastrointestinal issues and so on. So that's not good either. So you need to look at the label of the product you've got, whether it's one of those powders you can get, whether it's a gel. Most gels, from memory, I don't use them because I find the taste quite sickly sweet.
Yeah, you need to drink a lot of water with them.
Yeah. But those kind of things, you know, corn syrup was what used to be before it became commercialized. Huge back in the 80s, corn syrup, those tend to give you like 22 to 24 grams from memory, I think. Mm. It's in the low 20s for sure. So you need 3 an hour.
Mm.
It's quite a lot. That's a gel every 20 minutes.
In an Ironman, you'd have to be obviously carrying, you know, guys doing 6 hour Ironman.
Yeah,
that's going to be a lot of gels that you've got to attach to your body at some point.
Correct. Yeah. So, yeah. And I mean, some of the new sports drinks now have also capitalized on this glucose fructose combination method, and they can deliver higher concentrations. So you might not need, imagine what 120 grams an hour looks like.
Yeah.
We're sitting double. Here talking about 60 being quite demanding.
12 cans of Coke.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, not 12 cans. It's 1.2 liters of Coke.
Yeah, sorry, 1.2
liters
of Coke. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
So that's still a lot in
an hour. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And so, especially for runners, because there's also mechanical strain on the stomach from the bouncing up and down. Very difficult. Cyclists can get away with a little bit easier than runners can. But, you know, when we exercise, we've got this.
Yes, because cyclists aren't bouncing along.
Yeah, we've got, you know, the gut function is affected for three reasons. One is stress hormones, especially long duration.
Mm.
Your normal gut function is compromised by stress. Number two is blood flow. We send it, as I mentioned earlier, where it's needed, which is not the stomach.
Not the stomach, yeah.
And then the third one is mechanical stress, and that's much higher for runners than it would be for cyclists. So it's a real challenge, but it's become, I'd say actually in the last decade, gut training for carb ingestion has become one of the best ways to get an advantage. And now the athletes that are winning Ironman are doing 100 grams an hour in those races.
Just so they can get used, well, not, they're obviously doing 100 grams an hour during training to get their body used to it.
Exactly, yeah. So it's become built into the training program is how can I just get so much carb into my circulation? Not in my stomach, but into the circulation.
It's pointless in your stomach. You've got to get it into the body.
It's outside the body still. You've got to get it in. And
they will do that mostly with gels, I'm assuming, because that's the easiest way.
Gels and liquids. And
liquids, yeah. It's very difficult to do that if you're going to use whole foods.
Super difficult.
Or Coke.
Yeah, especially at those intensities. You know, your ultra trail guy that you spoke of earlier having sweet potatoes, it's not a major problem because they'll stop for 5 minutes at his food station and eat and chew.
Yeah.
But if you're in a race, you're not doing that. So
it was a very. I remember watching it actually while he was eating it, and it was cooked in a bowl, and it was just like a mash.
Mm.
So he wasn't eating whole sweet potatoes; he was eating it as a mash.
Help, yeah.
But that's quite a high GI that, which I was surprised at.
Yeah,
we'll get onto a little bit about GI in a moment.
Yeah, that's also important. So so the point I guess in all of this is that there's been a. I don't know if I'd call it a breakthrough, but certainly a shift. It used to be thought that as long as you gave your body enough that you didn't run out, you'd be good.
Yeah.
Now they've actually recognized that running out is the last sort of point in this thing, and you don't want to even get close to it. And actually, if you can deliver more to the muscle during exercise, you're actually better off. And the more you can get, the better. There's as I mentioned, a dose response. And so they began to experiment with ways. And as I say, the best way to do this is 60 grams of glucose per hour plus fructose, because then you get a combined effect. And that seems to have unlocked many, many benefits, you know. And then, by the way, the same is true in training. They've done studies where they deliberately induce overtraining. You take a group of guys who's used to cycling, say, 8 to 10 hours a week, and suddenly for 3 weeks they're doing 15 hours a week, high intensity for 15 hours.
Yeah,
they're going to overtrain. And if you split those athletes into two groups, one of which you give high carb or normal carb, which is, in this case, I remember it was 5.5 grams per kilogram per day. This is in your normal diet. And the other group gets 10 grams per kilogram per day. The group getting more carbs in training doesn't fatigue anything like as quickly as the group with low carbs. So by the end of the 3 week, this was a 2 week block, they do time trials before and after. Low carb group slowed down by 9-10%, high carb group 2-3%. So if you're doing hard training and you want to defend your training gains and recover from hard training, your carb ingestion over 24 hours makes a difference. And your carb ingestion.
Because we all think it's all about protein then, don't we? But it's actually not. It's about carbs as well.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. So it's energy. That's the body's currency is energy. And you know, it's like, I don't know, there's no analogy that works, but you know, protein and carbs and fats all provide what the body wants. Yeah, so it's an energy thing, and the carbs are protective against fatigue and against muscle damage, as I've said. So, yeah, this sounds like a great ad for carbs, but that's the reality. That's what all the science is showing in people who are training hard. And it's only when you take the training stimulus right down that you can get away with low carbs.
Mm. Any kind of intensity, I mean, let's just briefly touch on that. Any kind of intensity means that the facts are you need carbs and sugars to be able to do any sort of level of
intensity.
Yeah.
And so that's why. And we spoke about this earlier on. The holy grail for sports nutrition and athletes has always been, how can I reduce my reliance on carbs?
Yeah.
How can I burn more fat and thus less carb in order to go the same running speed or cycling power output or rowing or whatever it is? And that's where things like, and as I mentioned earlier, fitness does that. But aside from that, can we manipulate the diet? Can we add supplements like the ketone bodies and the medium chain triglycerides? And one of the methods that was used, and it got quite popular, was train low, compete high, which is to say train with low carb.
Oh, yes.
And then race with high carb.
Yes, I've heard that.
And so there were a number of ways in which you could train low. You could train first thing in the morning without eating any breakfast and go for a 2-3 hour session. By the time you finished it, 100% guaranteed your liver and your muscle glycogen are basically empty. And so for the last hour of that session, you will be low carb. So therefore you're burning more. You're driving fat because that's all your body has.
Forcing your body to use fat.
You can adopt a habitual low carb diet. So for 2 or 3 weeks, you eat basically no carbs and then you keep your normal training. You can do 2 training sessions a day. One in the morning, one in the afternoon, and not eat in between. So there were different ways of getting a low-carb training session in. The problem is you just can't train hard.
Yeah.
So there's a trade-off. You basically trade off high-quality training against carb efficiency or fat-burning efficiency, right?
Yeah.
And at some point, that trade-off is no longer worth it. And you're better off defending your training quality and consuming carbs than sacrificing quality on the altar of fat burning.
That's a good way of putting it. Let's just talk a little bit about, I mean, there's lots of discussion, particularly in ultra distance events like ultra trail events, which are 10 hours or more Ironman for some people. There's a lot of talk about GI and GL and all those sort of things. GI is
glycemic index.
Glycemic index, sorry. So GI is a high glycemic index. In other words, that's the stuff that goes through your system really quickly.
Yeah.
And GL is low, so that's the stuff that takes a long time to process.
Yeah, so glycemic index is quantified on a scale from 0 to 100. 100 being a dose of glucose, and how much does it? Strictly speaking, what they do is they'll give you a dose of glucose, I think 50 grams, and they measure what happens over the next 2 hours. And that sets the reference point.
Right.
Anything else that you take is then compared to that reference point. And basically what it quantifies is how much does this sugar load, this food, cause my blood glucose to go up and then come down? Does it happen quickly? Does it happen slowly? Is it a large increase that goes really high fast and then comes down like a super steep mountain peak? Or is it more like a little flat little hill? That's what it looks like.
Yeah, more plateau-y.
Yes. Now, the theory was that, and I mean, I guess still remains, that when we exercise, we want quick energy, but maybe not so quick that we cause spikes. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yes.
So that's why people started saying maybe we need low GI foods during exercise. The reality is that when we exercise, there's no insulin, because it's all shut off by the sympathetic stress response.
Right.
So the glycemic index is not really that important during exercise. And in actual fact, what you want is the energy to get from that bottle, gel, whatever it is, into your blood as quick as possible.
Mm.
In fact, you don't want it to take longer.
Yes.
Because it's not in the body yet. Yes. So there's no difference materially between sipping on a sports drink or whatever it is every 5 minutes as opposed to taking a low GI thing that sits in your stomach and only needing to sip every 30 minutes.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Same thing, yes.
Because in the end, they're delivering their sugar load, their currency.
It's an interesting way of looking at it, yes.
Because, all you're basically doing is letting your stomach hold it in storage for a little while.
Yes.
So why bother?
So inside the stomach rather than inside a bottle.
Exactly. And there's no realistic exercise situation that demands that because whether you're playing a football match, whether you are running in a marathon, there's a water table every 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's going to have sugar for you. If you're on your bike, there's going to be a water bottle on the bike or a sports drink bottle. And so you're probably better off having high GI drinks or fluids, sources, that you can access frequently than having low GI ones that you access infrequently. Because in the end, you get to the same point. Well, two different parts.
I mean, are we talking whole foods here when it talks about those? I mean, all those energy products that we talk about are all high GI, aren't they?
Yeah,
because they're designed to get into a system and work quickly.
Right, and they do that. They
work. Whereas baby potatoes and maybe a whole wheat peanut butter sandwich, for instance, would take a lot longer to digest.
Generally, glycemic index does fall across those lines, yes. Yeah. I know potatoes are quite high GI from what I recall looking at.
Because it depends if they have the skin on or off.
Yeah, exactly.
All those sort of things.
And that's where the glycemic index gets quite complex, because we very rarely consume only one source of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like lentils is a low GI food. But who eats a lentil?
Yes, you can't really take them in your...
And nothing else. Nothing else, right?
Yes.
So when we actually have a meal, a complex meal on a plate, GI gets quite complicated.
Yes.
Because that meal doesn't do what the components do. So the sum of the parts is not necessarily equal to the part, if that makes sense.
I thought the sum of the parts was equal to the part, because essentially... Whatever you have in a plate, whether it's a whole bunch of potatoes and a piece of meat and whatever, all of those things combined to a set.
Yeah, but quantifying that's very difficult, because you know, there's fat in there and proteins and carbs and some high GI foods, some low GI foods.
But if you have one with the other, for instance, that will lower the rate of which it goes. Yes, I mean, I know, for instance, a friend of mine who I ride with, he'll have a pastry at our coffee point, but then he'll also have a bag of bacon. Because his belief is, and he actually is pre-diabetic, but he has the bacon, so it slows down the glycemic reaction to that pastry with the protein.
Yeah, and fair. But what I'm saying is that, okay, A, we've now moved away from doing exercise because no one's got a lentil and a bacon in the pockets. But during exercise, the point is, how quickly can I get it from outside to inside and then to the muscle?
Yeah.
And there's very little reason to worry about low GIs and so on during exercise, because all you want is rapid disposal and oxidation.
Right.
And insulin is not a factor because we switch it off. So the insulin levels, even in response to like a huge volume of high GI liquid or food, is very low during exercise. At rest, sitting here as we are now, I could take that GI dose and my insulin levels would be sky high because my glucose would just react to it like an explosion of sugar in my blood. But in exercise, that doesn't happen because the situation's changed. The one place that the GI does become important is that pre-race breakfast or meal.
Yes, that was my next. My next question, actually.
Yes, so this is quite important, because what we eat before is important for two reasons. One is, if you eat it far enough in advance and it's large enough, it fills up the tank. That's carbo loading, which we can maybe get onto. But in the shorter term, it gets the tank, the liver glycogen especially, and it puts glucose into the system. So then when you start exercise, you're full up. It's like taking a car trip and filling up with gas before you leave the city. The problem is that when we are at rest, which is the case for breakfast or when we have our coffee stops on our rides, and now we're not shutting off insulin. So we're in a state at that moment, we're on the metabolic state where that ingestion of three sugars, my banana bread, croissant, whatever it is going to cause my blood glucose to go up. In response, insulin levels will go up. Yes?
Right.
And we know what insulin does, right? Mm. Insulin is going to tell the body to put that glucose in storage. That's its job. Store. It's a storage hormone. It wants to pack stuff away. And so insulin is then going to cause that blood glucose to be put into the muscle, to be put into the liver. And the problem then is that if you start exercise at exactly the wrong time, your blood glucose has actually gone down because insulin's trying to store it. And then you overlay exercise on top of that, which burns blood glucose, and all of a sudden you get hyperglycemic.
Right.
And that's called a rebound or a reactive hyperglycemia. And there are people for whom that is a major problem. And sometimes it happens to me. Do you remember the one time I missed the ride with you guys because I went to the wrong meeting point? And so I started 10 minutes after you and I had to chase you all the way to Cork Bay. I had a banana bread and two coffees there. And within 20 minutes of leaving coffee stop, I was absolutely shot hyperglycemic.
Yes.
Had to stop. Remember, we had to stop at a garage so I could have
that actually happens to me a fair amount.
And I had to drink two Cokes just to get home.
Yes.
And that's because in that rest stop, I took too long and I had too much sugar, and then I started exercise too late after stopping, after eating.
Right.
And I'd started to dispose of glucose and then exercise on top of it. Bad idea.
So it wasn't accessible?
Yeah, exactly. Now, so at that moment, my body was sending it in the wrong direction.
Right.
And then I started exercising over and above that, and my blood glucose would have fallen.
So what do you do then if you want to feel before a ride? How do you know how far in advance you need to do it to prevent that?
So you have a window, which has to either – you have a window of opportunity – actually, it's not a window. There's a window of failure.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
And you got to avoid eating in that window. You got to, therefore, you have to wait as long as possible before you start.
Before you eat?
Yes. So, in other words, you eat within 15 minutes of starting, or you drink a sports drink or something like fruit juice or whatever it is. Or you have to consume that meal 2 or 3 hours before.
So that the whole process
is complete by the time you start exercise.
So 2 hours before is actually quite right, but not an hour before.
But it depends, as so often is the case, on what you eat and how much. And the general rule of thumb is that for every gram of sugar per kilogram, you need an hour. So if you have if you consume 50 grams of carbs, you need about 1 hour before you start. If you consume 100 grams of carbs, you need about 2 grams.
2 hours.
Two hours, of course. Yes. So it's per kilogram. So let me try this again. If you're a 70 kilogram athlete and you consume 50 to 70 grams, 1 hour. If you're a 70 kilogram athlete who consumes 140 grams, 2 hours. Mm. 200 grams, 3 hours. Yeah. So that's the rule of thumb. So the bigger your meal, the longer it takes, which is obvious.
Yeah.
But yes, you do well to avoid. And that's why in our situation, I've now learned that if we stop for coffee or whatever it is, to finish the coffee and then go.
Yes.
You can't finish the coffee, enjoy the view, chat to other cyclists, talk about next week's ride, think about things, have another one.
A lot.
and then you finish the coffee at 9:30 and you're on the bike at 10:15. It's 40. That's too long. So you have to say to the waitress, "Can we have the bill, please?" Mm. Last sip, pay, ride.
That's interesting. Otherwise, you go into that risk state.
You could. So some people are much more susceptible to that than others. And there are actually interesting studies where they've done this in the lab and they've simulated that reactive hyperglycemia, that after drop.
Yeah.
And then they've made people do performances. And even though they feel really lousy, it doesn't actually affect their performance, which is quite interesting. Because they've still got the sugar there. It's just that the glycogen's fine. And everything's okay. It's just that their brains aren't seeing the blood glucose in that moment. So
fascinating. I never knew that at all. And it does explain a lot of the experiences I have on the bike. And it's those long stops. You feel worse after the longer the stop, the worse you feel.
Well, there's a few reasons for that. I mean, we also get your muscles get cold and suddenly you got to start
it's a combination
again.
Combination of things.
Yeah. But if you are aware that you get lightheaded, dizziness within 20 minutes of a stop or eating something, then you're a candidate for this reactive hyperglycemia. Yeah. And then you've either got to make sure you eat before, or sometimes what I do, for instance, now I've learned, if we're going to do a ride in the mornings and it's going to be a couple hours before I know we'll stop, I'll actually get on the bike, and while I'm pedaling really slowly to start, that's when I'll be drinking and eating something. Because now I've started exercise, and the key is, once I start exercise, my sympathetic nervous system is switching the insulin off.
Right.
So that player is gone. And now it's really just an exercise situation.
It makes an enormous sense, because the last few weeks when we've done long rides on the weekend, I've taken one of those little energy bars with me, called a Far Bar here in South Africa. But it's a little energy bar. I don't know quite how much is in it, but I have that as I walk out the door and I'm chewing it on the way down the road. And I've had my best rides when I've done that.
Mm.
And I haven't eaten that much on the ride other than that. But I've had my best rides, and I think you're right. It's switching that reaction off.
It's a classic example. We just got to be aware of it. And if you know it's you, then you either got to change your timing or what you eat, or both, in order to not fall into that window. You know, that's the problem is you invite insulin to a situation that's not welcome.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're running out of time a little bit here, but I think there's one last subject I wanted to talk about, because it is so current and people talk about it a lot on social media and lots of noise around this space. And that's the keto diets and the Banting diets and those sort of things. From my understanding is that it is definitely possible for athletes to be on keto diets. We know a couple of people in South Africa, they ride pretty well. But are they effective really? For the average person to be on a low carb diet in an extreme way, and still be as good as they could be as an athlete?
Yeah, it's a loaded question, obviously, because there's a broader context of habitual diets for health and life. And we're talking about the 1 to 3 hours a day of exercise. There's no evidence I'm aware of that elite athletes can sustain the quality and quantity of training necessary to be elite on those diets.
Right.
That's the first point, right? So when we're talking about Olympic level athletes, and there was a study, Louise Burke is another one of the world's most famous sports nutrition experts, and did a study looking at race walkers. Now, race walking is it's high intensity for what they're doing, but they're the lowest intensity Olympic athletes. You know, the 50K race walk that they used to do. Mm. I mean, that's nothing like your 1500 meter 10K guy, right?
Yeah.
And they did studies where they found that people on these low carb diets were inefficient compared to when they're on high carb diets. So their metabolic and overall performance efficiency was impaired. And the conclusion was that they probably didn't want their athletes on it because they couldn't train at the quality and achieve the same level of performance as when they had carbohydrates in the diet. Now, the criticism from the low carb side is that you have to take, it takes time to adapt.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that study, and I don't remember, I meant to look into this before I came and chatted today, but I forgot. The criticism is that you don't give them enough time. But then, you see, I'm trying to be practical, and I'm saying you're dealing with elite athletes. How much time do you need them to sacrifice? How much time out of that guy's year must he take to see whether it might be beneficial for him to adapt to a very low carb diet before he gets the benefit? Do you want 2 months of his training life? Do you want 4 months? And what if it doesn't work and he sacrifices 4 months of his training life for something that has no benefit? So that's why it hasn't taken hold at that level. And there have been lots of stories about athletes who are vegan and low carb and whatever else. But the reality is that when they need the carbs, they fuel the carbs.
Yeah.
You know, when we spoke to Professor Graham Close, he said principle number one is energy for the work required. And so even in an athlete who is habitually low carb, going out and doing a 6-day stage race or the Tour de France, we set aside all that stuff now. And now we're on 15 grams a day of carbs per kilogram body weight.
Yeah.
So for that level, now maybe thinking, all right, well, I'm not that level. Can I get away with it for my 4-hour marathon or even a 3-hour marathon runner? Mm. Probably can, yeah. You probably can.
Being on a low carb diet.
Yeah. Mm. I haven't seen data to show what the maximum rate of fat oxidation can be, because that's the key, right?
Yeah.
So let's say you're running a marathon with the Kenyans in London and you're running 204. Your energy consumption is probably 1,200 calories an hour, I would have thought. Huge. I mean, it's monstrous energy consumption. Now, can you provide that with fat? No. I've never seen anyone show that you can provide that much energy, calories per hour of fat. You know, 1,200 an hour from fat. I don't know. What's the highest fat oxidation rate ever recorded in man? I'm not sure. But I don't think it's that.
Yeah. Difficult to measure too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it does exist. And perhaps for our wrap-up of this endurance series, I should go and actually look it up before I come up with these ideas on the show like this. But whereas carbs, we know you can.
Mm.
So the athletes are making a pragmatic decision. But if you're someone who's doing a 4-hour marathon, you know, the interesting thing is your energy cost is about the same, but over 4 hours, not two. So now you need 600 grams an hour.
Yeah.
That's possible with fat. Even a 3-hour marathon, you need 800 grams an hour. That's probably possible with fats. Mm. So there will be a lot of quite good athletes who are very low carb, ketotic, because in response to their habitual diet and their training, they have just adapted to use fats more effectively than other people can.
Yeah.
But they're not winning races,
is
the point. Yeah.
So. Well, that is interesting. I guess to some extent, you know, there are lots of stories about people who are on keto diets. I mean, I know there's a local rider here in South Africa, Cape Town, who's, you know, does monstrous 200-kilometer rides and, you know, always talks about the fact that he's keto and not taking any fats and hasn't done for a decade.
Mm.
Obviously in very good shape as well, but he's also trains hard. You know, the idea that he's only doing this because he's on a particular diet, it nullifies the fact that he's actually adapted and he has trained pretty hard to do those rides.
Yeah, and so he's earned the right to burn the fat.
Yeah.
again, I come back, that study, it's a 2004 study by Achten, 14 days of deliberate overtraining. The people who are on lower carb diets don't do as well.
Yeah.
They get more tired, their mood state is negatively affected, their fatigue scores are up, muscle damage is higher, and their performances get worse. So yeah, you can go and do it. And I mean, I'm not, again, remember what we said in the beginning, there's no right or wrong, there's just appropriate and inappropriate.
Yeah.
And so there will be people listening to this who know that they've successfully done this low carb stuff. And I think that's wonderful for them. It might be that they've got some genetic difference. But what I'm saying is, don't tell everyone else that the same diet will work for them.
Mm.
And that works both ways, of course. Mm. Again, we've spoken a lot about the 120 grams of carbs per hour. Some of these people will have a heart attack at the thought of that much carb. They don't have that much in a month, never mind in an hour.
Yeah.
But this is what the research suggests works the best, is that there's a dose response. Higher carb diets give better performances acutely and chronically because they allow a better recovery and less overtraining indication and so on. So if I was to give advice to everyone collectively, that's what it would be. But on an individual basis, you might well be the exception. So
So
at the risk of undermining everything we've just said, like, there are going to be outliers. But I think what we've said here is the sound, scientifically based, evidence-based set of principles.
You can start with the principles and then operate on your own, figure out your own system from there, because the principles are a fairly solid base.
Right, and I mean, I hope we didn't really make a list of them, but the number one principle is that the rate sets the demand.
Yeah.
And you can meet that demand by burning fat or carbs, more easily carbs, but possibly fat, depending what it is. And then beyond that, everything is preference, you know? So how much do you prefer? How much can you tolerate? Is, you know, we've said here 100 grams an hour. Maybe you only deal with 50, in which case the extra 50 is only going to make you sick. So don't try it. Well, try it once and then you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the point is, understand that energy demand is the thing you're meeting.
Mm.
And you're paying for that. You're paying for that demand with carbs and fats, basically.
Right.
We haven't even touched on protein, but we needn't bother.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carbs and fats. And the less you can get away with on carbs, the better. But I think you're better off saying, I'm going to do everything I can to maximize carbs and then work backwards from there.
Yeah.
That would be my advice.
Yeah, good way to wrap it up. If you do have any questions around our Endurance Month here in February, please don't forget you can contact us on our Twitter feed, Sports SciPod. It's Sports and then SCIPOD. And, of course, Ross is on Twitter as well if you want to message him directly. But ask us any questions, because at the end of February, our podcast will include questions from you and particularly from our patrons who are supporting us on Patreon, where we will take questions and we'll hopefully get to answer your questions around endurance sport and all of the challenges that we face with that. So don't forget Sports SciPod on Twitter, Ross, of course, on Twitter, and our patrons as well. Don't forget you can visit our Patreon page at patreon.com. Just look for Science of Sport and all the details are on there, and you can contribute a small amount to our podcasts. But from us for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.